Welcome to That's History, our regular feature where we look at current events and find echoes, parallels, and lessons from the past. I'm Chris Cetullo, joined as always by Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history at New York University. Welcome, Jonathan. Good to have you back.
Good to be here as always.
Okay, Jonathan, today our topic is an historical fallacy much cherished by political pundits. And I will confess to you in this place that I have been guilty of said fallacy in the past. To summarize the fallacy in two statements, the first statement would be our political discourse in America has reached a new depth of poisonous toxicity. And statement two would be if only we could get back to that past golden age of civility where we had such a decorous politics. Why, Jonathan Zimmerman, are those fallacies?
Well, actually, it's the inverse. Mm-hmm. Our politics may be nasty and unreasonable for all sorts of reasons, but it has nothing, especially on the 19th century, on the so-called golden age of, you know, civil statesmen. The politics then was much more poisonous, much more rancorous, much meaner than our own.
So I'm thinking of the Founding Fathers. Certainly they weren't mean to each other, were they?
Well, Jefferson and Adams ran against each other in 1800, and these are obviously two of the most prominent statesmen in the history of the country. One of them the author of the Declaration of Independence, the other the second president and the first vice president. And although each of them kept a rather low profile, their respective campaigns said things about the other side that I think would shock even today's Trump-tinged ears.
For example?
Well, the Jeffersonian said that Adams wanted to marry one of his sons to one of King George's daughters in order to bring the United States back under British rule, to be part of the empire again. And the Adams camp said that Jefferson was, of course, an infidel. He did have, let's say, rather unorthodox religious beliefs. And because of that, they said that if Jefferson was elected, the entire civic fabric would go to pieces and there would be murder, rape, and mayhem all over the land. And those are the words that they used.
So these are the sacred and blessed Founding Fathers. I also understand that when we're talking about the Adams family, like father, like son in terms of dirty campaigning.
Indeed. In 1828, John Quincy Adams, the son of the second president, he's running against a newcomer named Andy Jackson. And the Jacksonians say that John Quincy Adams, too, is a, quote, royalist. They call him King John II and say that he's also plotting to somehow bring us back under the yoke of Great Britain. And they also say, most bizarrely, that he procured an American virgin for the lust of the Russian czar. And again, although this makes no sense to us, in a weird sort of way, it made sense in that context because, again, the consistent theme is the guy's a monarchist. Mm-hmm. He's a royalist. He's a suck-up to kings.
Presumably, there was nothing then about tossing the virgin into the volcano.
They didn't get to that. But, of course, the Adams camp, they gave as good as they got. And they said that Jackson was a bigamist because there were some allegation, possibly true, that he had married his wife before she had divorced her first husband, and also that he was a, quote, mulatto. And this begins a long and awful tradition within American campaigning of saying that your opponent is somehow a secret African.
Surely Abraham Lincoln, revered as he is, wasn't subject to this kind of material.
Oh, no, he was subject to exactly this kind of material and worse. His opponents said that he, too, was a secret Negro. They made all kinds of jokes and comments about his, quote, dark complexion. And then when he ran for reelection in 1864 against McClellan, the Democrat, who was a general that Lincoln, in fact, had fired, the Democrats said that if Lincoln's reelected and the Union wins the war, which they were going to, that he was going to institute interracial marriage. Again, a massive racial taboo in the United in the 19th century.
Yes, and you've provided us with a list of descriptions of Abraham Lincoln that one magazine of the time offered. Let me just run through a bit of it. Liar, thief, braggart, buffoon, usurper, monster, ignoramus, old scoundrel, perjurer, robber, swindler, tyrant, fiend, and butcher.
But Chris, let me emphasize, there were some bad things as well. It wasn't all peaches and cream back then.
I understand. So surely, you know, after we got past the nastiness of the Civil War and the country was reunited, this stuff toned down, right, during the Gilded Age.
Not at all. If anything, it accelerated. In 1876, the much-contested Hayes-Tilden election, the Democrats, the Tildenites, said that Hayes had stolen money from dead Civil War soldiers and had shot his mother. And Hayes's camp, the Republicans, simply replied that Tilden was a syphilic, that he had syphilis.
Okay, well, that's clearly a, you know, an excellent rejoinder to that discussion. So I'm not to to linger out the suspense at all, I'm presuming that this level of discourse continues into the 20th century as well.
It absolutely does. And sadly, race is often at the heart of it. So you find that Democrats say of Warren G. Harding, one of our least distinguished presidents, that he was secretly black. During the New Deal, anti-Semites said that Franklin Roosevelt was secretly Jewish. They talked about the Jew deal. And I would say in some ways the so-called birther charge against President Obama is a legacy of that tradition. Of course, nobody is questioning his race, but they are charging that he isn't exactly what he seems, right? They're questioning his nationality, sometimes his religion. And yet I would argue that the fate of the birther screed, if you will, shows actually a very sharp distinction between our time and the earlier times, insofar as the birther idea never really got into the mainstream campaign environment. Of course, Mr. Trump tried, but he failed. And so when you saw the Republican candidates assembled in two different groups, of course, the kiddie table and the main show, you didn't hear anybody mention the birther thing.
That would be last week's debate in Cleveland you're referring
Indeed.
To there. So looking back over the sweep of American history, is there even for the tiniest period a period where you can identify where things were a little bit less personal and insulting, or is it a straight line through?
I would say, if anything, they've gotten less personal and less insulting in our own era for a number of reasons, but I would say the major one are changes in the media environment. So we have in our mass media an ideal of objectivity. Of course, we can argue about whether we observe it or if it's observed in the breach. But in the 19th century, there was absolutely no such notion. So almost every newspaper was explicitly a partisan journal, and its goal was to take down the other team in whatever way it could. So the kind of screeds that we associate today with the darker corners of the internet, they were in the mainstream press, because the press dealt in every kind of accusation, any kind of accusation that could possibly harm the opponent, you found in a daily newspaper.
We're talking with Jonathan Zimmerman of New York University about the durability of insult and false accusation in American politics from the very first days of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson up to the modern day. Jonathan, I'm wondering one thing about the current environment, whether you have any thoughts as an historian about whether there's anything significantly different today, not so much on what's going on, but in the scope and the velocity of our media. I'm thinking about the explosion of social media, whether it makes it feel worse today than in the past just because it moves around the world so quickly.
I think there's no question about that. There's this multiplier effect, as people say. And so when Donald Trump makes a scurrilous remark, and let's be clear, he's made several, you hear it echoed, I think, with an immediacy and with a volume that you probably didn't hear in the 19th century. So I think it's tempting to then conclude that, of course, you know, our overall political environment has to be nastier than in earlier eras.
Thank you, Jonathan Zimmerman.
Okay, thanks. It was fun.
That's Jonathan Zimmerman of New York University. I'm Chris Satullo, and this was That's History.